Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome, everybody, to New Books in Environmental Studies. I'm your host, Emma Shortis. Today, we're joined by Dr. Tim Neal to discuss his book, Wild Articulations, Environmentalism and Indigeneity in Northern Australia, which was published by the University of Hawaii Press in 2017. Wild Articulations examines the controversy over the 2005 Wild Rivers Act in the Cape York Peninsula of Northern Australia. Through detailed analysis of the role of traditional owners, prime ministers, politicians, the media, environmentalists, mining companies, the late Steve Irwin, crocodiles, and even river systems, the book reveals the ways in which the future of the North was contested. In the process, Wild Articulations reveals the overlapping, contesting, and sometimes surprising relationships between environmentalism, indigeneity, and development. And it shows how the Act both revealed and fundamentally altered the politics of environmentalism and indigeneity in Northern Australia. Dr. Neal is a research fellow at Deakin University's Alfred Deakin Institute for Citizenship and Globalisation in Melbourne, Australia, which is where he joins us from now. Welcome, Tim, to the New Books Network.
Thank you for having me.
It's our pleasure. So, Tim, I wonder if you might begin today's podcast just by telling us a little bit about yourself and how you came to a research focus that bridges this gap between human geography and cultural anthropology.
Well, I was finishing a master's in Auckland University. I'm from Aotearoa, New Zealand, and decided that I drastically needed to shift my research focus. I'd become very interested in what you might call historical geography of place through reading people like Jeff Park and Barry Barclay. I'd become very interested in kind of how we produce national parks, how we produce kind of spaces of what we encounter as nature. But I was young and not sure if I wanted to do a PhD, so I sat around for 2 years working at a bookshop and then eventually decided I needed to apply to some PhD programs because I was really convinced that this was the thing for me. And so I ended up in a PhD program at the University of Melbourne with the idea that I was going to do a study of a kind of comparative study, which doesn't really happen very much between Aotearoa and Australia. I was thinking I was going to look at how different Indigenous groups had used forms of conservation like national parks in different ways, sometimes to protect their interests, because I had this great example in New Zealand of Tuwharetoa and iwi in the Northern Ireland using the national park kind of framework as a way to protect their interests for a period of time. However, then I came to Australia and I was just, you know, blown away by these kind of political controversies that were happening at the time around the development of Indigenous land. There were kind of two things happening at once. In the Kimberley region of Western Australia, right up in the north, there was an Indigenous group that was very actively against the placing of a gas hub by the multinational Woodside Company. This is a place called James Price Point or Walmerdam. And then in the other side of the north of Australia, Cape York Peninsula, there was a number of different groups who were variously kind of for and against this piece of conservation legislation called the Wild Rivers Act. And it was in the newspapers and it was everywhere, and it seemed to have all these elements about it that intrigued me. And very early on, my supervisors were like, oh, you have to chase this. You're clearly very interested in it. It has to do with all these things you're interested in, belonging, how we are going to negotiate the ownership of land, in the aftermath of kind of the recognition of Indigenous land rights, what conservation means today, et cetera, et cetera. And so they really pressed upon me, you know, this was the way to go. However, also to get back to your question, it was clear from the beginning that I was going to have to take quite a interdisciplinary approach to this, that the actors who were involved were so dispersed that it wasn't going to be possible to study them in one place, that you had conservationists in an urban city, you had people working in an Indigenous NGO in a regional city. You had people living out in the remote areas of Cape York, all these different dispersed actors. So there wasn't going to be a single field site, and I would have to take a kind of interdisciplinary approach to that.
Fantastic. And the book is wonderfully interdisciplinary. But before we get into that in more detail, I thought I might just ask you if you could tell us a little bit more about the Cape York Peninsula itself, especially for those listeners who might not be familiar with the place.
Sure. So Cape York Peninsula is a kind of massive peninsula. It's not even really a peninsula. It's so huge. It's over 137 square kilometres, which, to give you an idea, is larger than Greece, larger than the North Island of Aotearoa. Like, it's a very massive place, and it's got a number of different kind of interesting histories. It's about 10,000 years ago. It was the last kind of part of Australia that was connected to what is now Papua New Guinea. So it was the last land bridge between the Australian continent and the rest of the world. And it's a place that was the first place that was to be visited by European settlers. So the Dutch in the early 1600s arrived, and it was the first place that Europeans made landfall on the Australian continent. And they had a very unpleasant time of it. They tried to kidnap some people and quite reasonably were turned away. And then throughout kind of the next few centuries, it was a place where European colonizers tried to come, but kind of failed to penetrate. So over time, this is an argument I make in the book, it's kind of resisted the forms of Western capitalist settlement, just through its ecology, but also through its population, to the point where now, this massive landmass has a resident population of about 18,000 people. And that seasonally varies because it has quite intense monsoon through kind of November to April, which, again, kind of has meant that also a lot of its ecological values, as we might call them if we were ecological scientists, have remained, quote unquote, intact. So it's an area that has very large pastoral stations, very large national parks, very large areas that have very few introduced or exotic species. So therefore, it's been seen for quite a long time as a kind of ecological marvel. And so you've got these very large rivers that don't have dams on them. As I say, very large savannas that are relatively, quote unquote, intact.
Yeah, so it's quite an extraordinary place by the sounds of it. And we'll get back to this question of wilderness soon. But before we do that, the major focus of the book, or the book is kind of centered around this 2005 Wild Rivers Act, which you argue isn't just a law but an event, and one that revealed and fundamentally altered the politics of environmentalism and indigeneity in Australia. But before we get to how exactly it did that, I wondered if you could explain a little bit about the Act itself, kind of what it did and why it was and remains so controversial.
So there's a number of ways of covering this, but the first one is the boring policy one, which is that it was part of a suite of measures by a liberal in the North American context, or what we call down here a Labor government, implementing a number of environmental regulations. So throughout the early 2000s, this Labor government came in after a long period of conservative government and decided that it was going to change a number of different environmental regulations. The water regulations were changed, land clearing regulations were changed. And then part of the suite was in the middle of an election campaign, the premier, so the head of the state government, announced that he was going to protect Queensland's quote-unquote wild rivers. And what this meant effectively was both practically there would be no development on a set number of rivers that were deemed to have many of their ecological values intact, but also it was a publicity or a branding campaign of kind of underlining Queensland's, green credentials, its touristic credentials. So something I didn't mention about the Cape is that a lot of the eastern side of Cape York Peninsula is bracketed by the Great Barrier Reef, one of Australia's largest tourist attractions, you know, a multi-billion dollar tourist attraction. And there has been and remains a very big concern about forms of development in places like Cape York affecting the Great Barrier Reef and therefore affecting the economy and the ecology of that place. So in 2004, the Labor government comes out with this big policy and says, we're going to protect these rivers for forever and there'll be no dams on them. And it was a great piece of branding. In the initial years, they had a lot of bipartisan support from not only the conservative side of government, but also a number of Indigenous figures in Far North Queensland, or at least some of the most prominent ones, said, you know, that they were for it. Because on the face of it, it didn't seem to do very much, you know, it was, as I say, a piece of branding. But over the years that followed, people became more and more, trepidatious about what was being foreclosed by putting some restrictions on the development around these rivers. And what was being foreclosed included not only things that might happen, but the ability of Indigenous people with land rights to some of these places being able to negotiate with third parties about what might happen. So through 2009 in particular, and then 2011, again, there were kind of waves of public lobbying and protesting by particular Indigenous groups against the Act, and then as well public lobbying and protesting by some Indigenous groups who were for the Act. So that's the long and short of it. Later on, it continues in a zombified form today, as I explain in the book. When a Conservative government came into the state government in 2012, they came in promising they were going to get rid of it. This will be, gone before you know it. However, it took them a number of years to figure out what might replace it. And when they did eventually replace it, very quietly, it was with regulations that were almost exactly the same.
So it exists even today.
In a zombified form, it exists under a different name, yes.
It's a really interesting point you raise and kind of leads, I think, into my next question, which is one of the first issues that you raise in the book, and that's this question of wildness. So what does the wild in the wild rivers mean?
Well, it's funny, as I point out, the community consultation documents produced by the government, so when they went out to, these remote places in Cape York and tried to consult with people about the Act, they actually have this amazing phrase, which is, we have to acknowledge wild for its duplicity of meaning. And so they acknowledge actually within these very bureaucratic documents that it has these double meanings. And what they mean by it in that case is, on the one hand, wild as an uninhabited place, you know, a kind of sublime, unpeopled landscape that is kind of capital N nature in its fullness. And then on the other hand, wild is for them a kind of clean green branding, image. It's the image of nature, not necessarily unpeopled, but, healthy, resplendent, small in nature, I suppose. And this is what they see or thought they saw when they were, you know, putting together this act and going out and consulting with people. But as I point out in the book, you know, Wild has this very rich, deep and complicated history, kind of no matter where we look, whether we're looking at, you know, Aristotle and early Greek ideas of the wild as the thing outside the city that's defined as the thing outside the city, or wildness, as I mentioned, as a kind of chaotic energy or an ability to, in the form of the Joker in a pack of cards, the wild, the Joker is wild because he can move between sets. He doesn't have any ownership, you know, he doesn't belong anywhere. He's a free-floating signifier. And so all of this this history, I thought, for me, really need to be brought to bear because it explains something about how wildness is both at this point overdetermined with value. Like to this day, you know, all you need to do is go to a supermarket or turn on your TV and you'll see things being pitched to you in the discourse of wildness, whether it's, you know, to go to a particular beautiful place or it's to eat a particular superfood, you know, wildness is there and it's alive. But it's kind of inexhaustible. We can keep giving it meaning to suit ourselves. And I think that for me was a way of getting into what was happening in the Wild Rivers Act, that people were using it, whether they were on the side of the government or not, people were still using this word and this this discourse to try and attach value to what they thought was most important.
Yeah, okay. And in the book, you sort of situate this in a longer historical process of what you call placemaking or the wilding of Cape York Peninsula. So could you take us through a little bit of that history and that process of placemaking?
Yeah, so this was kind of where I ended up in thinking that these wild places are not wild at all. They're peopled. They've been populated in the case of Cape York Peninsula. They've been peopled for tens of thousands of years by, you know, thousands and thousands of people, generations of people who have shaped that place. And so therefore that kind of led me to think, well, how did we end up in a place of nonetheless being able to think of these places as wild? And the clues came for me in looking at the history of white settlement in that place and white exploration of that place as a process that had produced it as wild, that had, you know, as I put it, a process of wilding, that they had to kind of produce it through forms of textual production, like making maps, writing novels about lost, you know, the wild white men that get lost in this place over the 19th century and become themselves native, or to use their own phrasing, and to see therefore the wildness of this place as something that's produced through all these kinds of I guess, discursive production, whether that is, early settlers, let's say, people like Edmund Kennedy, who was one of the first white settlers to try and explore the Eastern Cape, and it was a disastrous trip. I can't remember the exact numbers. I think there were 14 people went on the trip. Two survived. Most of them died through starvation or getting lost. However, one of the people who survived went on to write their recollection of the trip that then got published multiple times. And in their recollection of the trip, they present Cape York as this place filled with treacherous Aboriginal people, filled with treacherous environments, inhospitable. And, you know, this becomes exactly these kinds of texts became so crucial to people in other places understanding this as a hostile or wild, you know, uncivilized place. And we can track that, as I do in the book, over the centuries, whether that's early explorers like Kennedy or later settlers who tried to bring cattle to that to the north, subsequent police forces, development projects in the throughout the 20th century that continue to, in various ways, write this place and thereby produce it as wild in different ways, as either full of environmental values, to go back to the language I was using before, you know, exotic species, and I'd say exotic in this, you know, in terms of marvelous species of birds and huge numbers of crocodiles and all these kinds of, you know, non-human actors that we value as nature, and at the other hand, undeveloped, unpeopled, you know, uncivilized, and therefore just waiting for capitalism and its forms of industrialization to turn up and transform it into something worthwhile.
Okay, and so from this kind of deep historical perspective on wilding and placemaking, the book then turns to a kind of more concentrated survey of discourse specifically around the Wild Rivers Act. It surveys this media coverage specifically of the Act. So could you explain how this coverage unfolded and how it can help us to better understand broader trends in environmental politics in Australia at around this time?
Yeah, so I took a bit of a weird approach to this, perhaps, in that I took quite a media studies approach to the production of the Wild Rivers Act controversy. So obviously the controversy was unfolding in some of those sites that I was mentioning before, whether that's in Cairns, you know, the major city of the very south of Cape York Peninsula, or Brisbane, where a lot of the environmentalist NGOs were, or Canberra, the nation's capital, where a number of people, traditional owners, Indigenous traditional owners from the Cape, as well as other Indigenous interests, went to lobby politicians. And in order to try and track that, I thought, well, what I could do is actually look at this controversy as it was produced in news media, as an example of the production of controversy, I suppose. So I decided to focus on the Australian print news media across those different sites, the ones that were written, you know, in places like Cairns, the ones that were written in places like Brisbane, the forms of journalism that were being produced out of Canberra, in order to kind of produce that as a scene or a site of contestation. And so I took quite a quantitative approach. I tried to, using various databases, I accumulated all of the press coverage I could find, I put it in a database, and then I started crunching the numbers of trying to look at whose voice was getting the most prominence, who was getting quoted the most often, what kinds of language were they using, when did the coverage occur over time, and which newspapers and outlets deemed it worthy of attention. And discovered through that a number of things that were reasonably obvious to people involved in the controversy, that there was a particular newspaper, The Australian, which is a Murdoch News Limited newspaper that has for a long time considered itself a major mover in the world of Indigenous affairs, and that The Australian had really dominated the terms of debate from very early on, had picked it up as an issue, decided that it was going to take a very strong stance and that would privilege certain voices, and that was demonstrable in therefore in the data that I started to produce. but also through that, how they were constructing environmentalists at this time. So it was an interesting time in Australian politics more generally in terms of the rise of green politicians within the federal and state governments that in response to this, different newspapers, including The Australian, took a very strong stance. And I won't go into how bad it was, but effectively at different points said that green politicians were treasonous for, you know, standing in the way of Australia's mining economy, that they should be, I remember one columnist saying something like they should, the head of the Green Party should be hung from a lamppost. And so this was part of the context of The Australian taking a campaign against this piece of environmental legislation and taking an interest in it. So I could demonstrate that through the chapter and through that how they were producing not only environmentalists as a particular kind of evil, as inappropriate to be involved in the in matters of regional and remote Australia, that they were inner city liberal greenies drinking lattes and they should stay out of it. So this kind of production of discursive production of the greenie, and on the other hand, the production of a certain kind of indigenous entity or agent who was a legitimate force. So The Australian really privileged a particular set of indigenous actors who were against the Wild Rivers Act and were variously for forms of development as well as forms of welfare quarantining and policing of indigenous people. And they really worked against drawing attention to the interests of particular pro-conservation Indigenous traditional owners.
Which is a really interesting dynamic, I think. And then in the following chapter, you build on this analysis by going kind of deep into this controversy and examining in detail two particular histories that these stakeholders bring up again and again. Could you tell us a little bit about these two histories and why those histories in particular were invoked?
Yeah, so we have, I suppose, one that people may know a little bit about is in Australia, this history or idea of a green-black alliance. And what that is varies depending on who you talk to. My colleague Eve Vincent and I have an edited collection where we try and go into this a little bit more. But it's this idea that on the one hand, Indigenous people are fundamentally conservationists and therefore have a fundamental connection to environmentalists. So that there's a kind of ideological pairing or a natural pairing, a natural alliance between those two groups. False as that is, that's you know, a kind of common understanding. And what that's grounded in, on the other hand, is a historical set of events where Indigenous people and environmentalists have actually paired up in common cause. So I mentioned these in the book, and as I said in the edited collection, some of the most famous ones are kind of campaigns against uranium mining in the Northern Territory at a place called Jabiluka. Campaigns against different forms of development elsewhere in Australia, and crucially in Cape York Peninsula in the 1990s, a campaign that was explicitly called a Green-Black Alliance by the Indigenous and non-Indigenous actors who were part of it. And what this campaign centered around in the 90s was the return to Indigenous ownership of a set of properties that had quite inexplicably been turned from cattle properties into freehold title in the late 80s and early 90s. So to give you a very short précis, a Conservative government said to a bunch of developers, you can turn these cattle properties that have never been productive as cattle properties into freehold land that you can then develop. And one of the ideas was to have this big resort in Cape York. Another was to have a space base, as they called it, which was to have a rocket launching site and attached tourist resort on one of these sites, which also ran alongside the Great Barrier Reef. And Indigenous and non-Indigenous people in the early 90s, these environmentalists attached to these large environmentalist NGOs, in particular traditional owners, paired up and lobbied national politicians, lobbied state politicians, went on various kind of speaking roadshows to try and stop these development projects and get the land returned to its traditional owners. And they were successful in that. So in the mid-90s, as I quote in the book, there are various statements by many of these people about this alliance and the pairing of these interests, only for then in the Wild Rivers Act, many of those same people to now be at odds. One of the most prominent Indigenous actors, a kind of public intellectual and advocate named Noel Pearson, you know, in the 90s had been part of this Green Black Alliance, and come the Wild Rivers Act controversy slightly over a decade later, is very against conservation, is very pro the industrialization of the Cape York Peninsula. And so in order to understand that and understand, as you're saying, how this history was being invoked, you need to track back into that. So the second history that I mentioned is that people brought up was this idea that the Wild Rivers Act was quote-unquote, worse than Bjelke Petersen. Now, who was Bjelke Petersen? Australians will know him very well. Famously, Sir Joe. Some people called him the hillbilly dictator. He was the premier of Queensland through a very infamous period of Queensland politics. Now, it's infamous not only because in the late 1980s, after serving for an incredibly long time, I think over 19 years, the government fell in ignominy around police corruption and what was pretty clearly ministerial corruption, so high levels of government involved in corrupt activities. But it was also infamous as a period in which, under Bjelke Petersen's leadership, Queensland lagged behind the rest of Australia in terms of progressive Indigenous policy, that Bjelke Petersen was understood to have been somebody who stood in the way of forms of self-determination that were being unfolded elsewhere in Australia, particularly led by the federal government, whether that was in terms of what was called the Homelands Movement, of people, Aboriginal people moving back out into remote areas of their traditional lands, or whether that was in terms of land ownership, you know, forms of title being passed to Aboriginal people to their traditional lands, whether that was in forms of urban Indigenous people's rights, that it was seen to be a period of extreme discrimination against Aboriginal people, which now, you know, is wedged in, understandably wedged in people's minds as something both within living memory and, you know, an extraordinarily oppressive time to live through. It was also a time in which Indigenous people in Cape York really fought against these forms of oppression through forms of litigation. So there were a number of kind of famous cases where communities in Cape York fought against the Bjelke Petersen government by taking up legal challenges, whether that's to the Australian courts or the Privy Council in the UK, and being reasonably successful, being quite successful, I should say. And so these ideas were, again, invoked during the Wild Rivers Act as a way of explaining how bad this thing was. How bad was this piece of conservation? Well, it was worse than Bjelke Petersen. And therefore, it was also required the kind of response that Indigenous people had had to the Bjelke Petersen government in terms of activism, in terms of litigation. And so that was the second kind of crucial history that I think people need to understand when trying to address what the Wild Rivers Act controversy was.
Absolutely. And I think, as you point out in the book, it raises some really interesting questions about who gets to speak, particularly for Indigenous people. And you mentioned Noel Pearson, who's a towering figure in Indigenous politics in Australia. And in the fourth chapter of the book, you address this role of Noel Pearson, a kind of ostensible leader or executive advocate, as you call him, and this kind of split that he has with some traditional owners. So could you tell us a little bit about that split and this idea of kind of re-articulating indigeneity in that context?
Yeah, there's this great phrase that I come back to in the work of an Australian anthropologist, Francesca Merlin, where she says that in Australia, tradition is the coin of indigeneity. And what that means is what Merlin is talking about is that through the past few decades of the recognition of Indigenous people, particularly within land rights regimes in Australia, that the Australian courts and Australian political system, settler political system, have really fixated upon Indigenous tradition as the site for recognition. That in order to have land rights, you have to have your traditions intact. You know, this is all the language that you get in these judgments, that Indigenous groups who continue their traditional rights and customs. And what this means is those groups that have been least, not affected, but least have had their geographical location and their ability to speak their language and conduct their traditions as they see fit, those who have been impacted the least by those forms of disturbance are the most recognizable, are the most legitimate according to the laws. And what this is, as I point out, meant is that the sedimentation over time of an idea that traditional owners are the singular kind of authorities on Indigenous issues. However, this has a lot of tension with people like Pearson and a number of other people, but I use him as a good example, of people who don't speak from a place of traditional authority but have a very large public profile because of their advocacy, because of their prominence in policy debates, because of their prominence in other forms of representation, whether those are elected forms of representation or kind of forms of representation through business, that there's a tension there between what I call the executive advocates, those who operate as this kind of executives, and on the other hand, traditional owners, people who speak from a grounding in the recognition of their tradition by the state and their culture. So that tension, as I point out in the book, is often not really well understood when we have debates about Indigenous lands and Indigenous interests here in Australia. I think it's poorly understood, and because it's poorly understood, therefore people can get into all kinds of trouble, but also can play all kinds of games in that they can try and pick and choose their favorite Indigenous representative. The other problem is, as you point to, what do people like Pearson, what do executive advocates do when their views of what is best, when their views of how we should legislation or development projects should proceed clash with those of local people, clash with those of traditional owners? And this is something that the Wild Rivers Act, I think, really for the first time made quite explicit, made unavoidable, and therefore proved a good site for us to gain some insight into how these different authorities have kind of become positioned within Australian politics.
Absolutely. And then this kind of coalesces, I guess, around the multiple parliamentary inquiries that then happen, that then look at the Act in detail, which is the subject of Chapter 5. So could you tell us about these inquiries and how this split and all this coalescing kind of plays out in those?
I think Australian parliamentary democracy, like a lot of parliamentary democracies in this world, love nothing more than an inquiry. An inquiry is a great way to make people feel that they've been heard. It's a great way to delay any decision making. It's a great way to take the heat out of political controversies. So, there's this idea we get from science and technology studies of hot situations. You know, and the Wild Rivers Act was very much a hot situation. It was a controversial situation, had a lot of heat in it. And parliamentary inquiries are a great way to keep things cool, or to take the heat out of things. And the federal Labor government saw this. And so they sent the Wild Rivers Act to a total of 6 parliamentary inquiries, only 3 of which really had any substance, and only 4 of which had any hearings. But the 3 that I really focus on, you know, were very large events where these panels of Australian politicians, federal politicians, so nationwide politicians, went to different places in which the Wild Rivers Act was a controversy. You know, some of the places I was mentioning before, Brisbane, Cairns, Aurukun, Weipa, these places in Cape York, Chulungun, which is a homeland in Cape York, went to these places to hear what people thought of the Wild Rivers Act. And I use this partly because I went to some of these inquiries and found them really fascinating kind of moments, but also because it's kind of an ideal moment of narrative where people produced their narratives about what they felt the Wild Rivers Act meant and how it was an imposition or a benefit or something beneficial to their lives. Because I think something that we can get fixated upon in these kinds of studies, looking at a controversy, is that you can go and talk to people who are affected by something and discover that they don't have an exactly precise legal understanding of it. And some people might therefore dismiss people on that basis. Or you might go and talk to people and discover that their concern is not the Wild Rivers Act, but something else. And therefore, their concern isn't really, quote unquote, the Wild Rivers Act. But by going to these inquiries, it enabled me to see, and therefore it provided a kind of crucial and I think an important way for me to therefore re-narrate how people were narrating the future of Cape York, how they were narrating what their aspirations were for this place that, clearly the state wanted to brand as wild, wanted to brand as, a site of touristic adventure and potentially green business. How did they, whether they were Indigenous or non-Indigenous, how did they imagine the future of this place? And through doing that enabled me to represent back to, in this book, it provided a very crucial way of understanding that some of these dreams were themselves invoked ideas of the wild, that they required you to think of kind of Cape York is a place that might be magically transformed by the powers of capital and innovation. We didn't quite have the language of disruption at that point, but, I think if we had the Wild Rivers Act controversy today and these inquiries, people would be talking about disruption. But it was, the magical promise of development, which so many people have written about, is clearly like a powerful social imaginary in this place. And whereas a number of other people who are imagining the future of this place, were really wrestling with an understanding, personal intimacy with kind of material limits of transformation that, to go back to what I was saying at the very beginning of our interview, that this place has historically resisted forms of capital exploitation through its environment, through its population, through its remoteness. And that remoteness, therefore, it's distance from development. It's not a mistake. It's not an error that can be easily, you know, ironed out. And the inquiries were a place for kind of the interrogation of some of these wild dreams of development, as well as the representation of some of the more pragmatic work that people are actually going about in order to try and produce, you know, livable futures in that place.
Yeah, okay. And then I guess all these different worlds, different futures and different imaginaries collide again in the Wenlock River area, which is the subject of the final chapter, chapter six, which opens with this really interesting question, which you say is naive in the book, but I'm not sure it is. And that question is, what is a river? So what is the Wenlock River?
Well, it's so many things. And as you say, I use the Wenlock again as a kind of, I could have written about a number of different rivers, I guess, in Cape York, but it was a perfect example of these values that different people had attached to it and their competing visions of what it was and should be. So on the Wenlock River, we have not only the site for a lot of prospecting of bauxite, the key ingredient for producing aluminium or aluminum. So these red pebbles that you can refine and then smelt into aluminium and turn into cans and all kinds of brilliant things, like the shell of the MacBook that I'm using today. So there's all been all this prospecting and dreaming about the future of that bauxite, you know, which is a material presence. It's a layer that's been formed over millennia there. There's also on that same river and overlapping some of that bauxite is the Steve Irwin Wildlife Reserve, a place that was, has all this rich imagery of the crocodile hunter, the khaki-clad TV celebrity that, is known around the world. There is a nature reserve there run by his family that was dedicated by the Prime Minister in his name was potentially threatened by this bauxite mining. And then further up the river, we've got cattle properties, which people hope to turn into sustainable businesses. We've got homelands where people are pursuing people like David Cloudy, who I mention a lot in the book. He's a traditional owner, Kanju traditional owner from Chulungun, has these an idea of homelands development that is, you know, indigenous directed development on country of sustainable, small scale, sustainable businesses. But all of these things are put into relation by the flow of the river, and I'm really persuaded by this this kind of optic, and it became crucial for me for seeing the relationships between people were in some ways relationships that were put in place or manifested in the form of this massive catchment of these massive rivers, partly because water is so crucial to life in a place like that. So what that brought me to was a cosmopolitical view. And I borrow this from Isabel Stengers and a number of other people who have developed this work in science and technology studies, of trying to come at political problems in a different way by establishing a greater form of equity between people's projects of world making. And why I do this is because I think in the ways in which a number of the people that I encountered with these kinds of controversies, particularly the Wild Rivers Act controversy, is that you end up choosing the worlding that you prefer. You know, the one that's legitimate is the indigenous on country vision of connection to place and sustainable development. Or the one that I prefer is the bauxite mining, because that is the one that will bring in money and development and jobs that will really transform this place and make it a better place to live for a number of different people. And taking the cosmopolitical proposal, which is, as Stenger says, a proposal, means that you therefore have to take seriously the a kind of equivalency between these and put them in relationship to each other without saying from the beginning which one should be preferred. And this is where I end up as a proposal for how we should come at these controversies in the future. Because to date, the preference, you know, to go back, the preference of various media outlets, the preference of various political parties has been to pick the one that you that most accords with your vision and say that that's the legitimate one. And that this can't be the way that we proceed in scholarship. We have to try and see all of these dreams or all of these imaginings of place as grounded in legitimate desires and values, and thinking cosmopolitically is a way to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a wonderful insight for our times now as well, particularly. But Tim, I have taken up an awful lot of your time. So I'd like to finish up this discussion with a kind of traditional question that we like to ask all of our guests. And that is, after this enormous and really important project, what are you working on next?
Well, there's a funny connection, which is while I was doing fieldwork in Cape York, I encountered, as one does in Northern Australia, an abundance of fire that for me as a New Zealander was quite an unusual experience, because in New Zealand we don't have a lot of fire in the landscape. What North Americans call wildfire, or what here in Australia is called bushfire. And it was just a fact of life in Northern Australia. And I found this really intriguing. And so when I finished this project, I ended up coincidentally in a postdoc where I had an opportunity to study people who manage fire in different parts of Australia. And I ended up doing field work in southwest Victoria, which is very wet part of the world, but that gets a huge amount of wind off the center of the continent. And so very like California, dries out in the summer and becomes extremely flammable and very dangerous. And then the other place I did work was in Darwin, in Northern Australia and the Northern Territory, where fire is, you know, an everyday presence. You know, approximately 40% of the savannas in Northern Australia burn every year. It's just a kind of fact of life. And I became intrigued by how people dealt with fire as sometimes an emergency, sometimes a benefactor, sometimes a thing that was, you know, fun, sometimes a threat. And have ended up studying, how these people who I call practitioners manage the uncertainties around their work. And so I'm very much in the fire world now, and I'm doing work on how people are using fire in the north for the creation of carbon credits, as well as how people are using forms of modeling here in the south to try and predict the future of fire. So I guess I'm still very interested in the production of environmental futures and how people narrate and produce those futures through their narrations of them.
Well, it sounds fantastic. And I think from water to fire is quite a nice transition. So
I need to hit all the elements eventually.
Well, we look forward to hearing more about them on New Books Network soon. Thank you so much, Tim Neal, for being on the show today.
It's been a pleasure.
That was Dr. Tim Neal, Research Fellow at Deakin University's Alfred Deakin Institute for Citizenship and Globalisation in Melbourne, Australia, discussing his book, Wild Articulations, Environmentalism and Indigeneity in Northern Australia, which was published by the University of Hawaii Press in 2017. Thanks, as always, for joining us.